I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver. This is thecommentary.ca. Christy Blatchford joins me now. The Globe and Mail columnist is a high-profile journalist in this country. She has a new book out, Helpless, Caledonia's Nightmare of Fear and Anarchy, and How the Law Failed All of Us. It's a compelling book about the standoff near the Six Nations Reserve in Caledonia, Ontario, beginning in February 2006. It's a shocking story whereupon lawlessness reigned under the noses of the Ontario Provincial Police. We'll talk about what happened, why we need to know about it, and what we can learn from it. Christy Blatchford has worked for the Toronto Star, the Toronto Sun, the National Post, and has been back at the Globe and Mail since 2002. She is the winner of a National Newspaper Award, and in 2008 was awarded the Governor General's Literary Award for her last book, 15 Days. Helpless is published by Doubleday. I've long been an admirer of her work. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Christy Blatchford. Good morning, Ms. Blatchford.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. So what happened here? It's a subdivision that was being built, was it?
That's right. It was going to be a residential subdivision. There were about 12 houses in various states of construction. I think a couple were finished, and others were almost finished. And this subdivision called Douglas Creek Estates sits smack in the middle of this little town of Caledonia. It's right on the main street, Argyle Street. And it was intended originally to, in the first phase, I think, to have about 450 homes there. And it's surrounded on one side, just a little bit to one side, by the Six Nations Reserve, on another by a county line called the Sixth Line, on yet another side by an already open and an existing residential subdivision known as Sycamore. So there were a lot of people who lived adjacent or very close to the site.
Now, the land that Douglas Creek Estates is on, was that Six Nations Reserve land?
No, it wasn't. At least it hasn't been recognized as such yet. It's a complicated story, as many of these land claim stories are, and I don't pretend to be an expert, but basically the Six Nations elected council position on this piece of land was not that it had been improperly surrendered or anything like that, but rather that it had been sold for too little money. So theirs was a monetary claim. The Haudenosaunee hereditary chiefs, on the other hand, believed and claimed that the original traditional chiefs who had sold the land had been tricked, and they did believe there was a land claim. And Ottawa, the federal government, which is the only body in this country which can negotiate land claims, didn't recognize that there even was a legitimate land claim. And Ottawa, it should be noted, has recognized, many hundreds of other land claims, but didn't recognize this one. So that's the brief summary.
So February 26, 2006, how many people, I guess, started the occupation?
I think fewer than a dozen people. Protesters showed up at the main gates to the subdivision and blocked the road, and they blocked workers from going in to work in the houses, and the house builders from going in to check on the work, etc. And the builders and the workers at first, the police were there. The OPP is the contract police force there, the Ontario Provincial Police, and they showed up. But their only action that day and for the ensuing few days was to put up traffic cones to make sure that nobody got hit by cars, because it's a busy street. But they did not attempt to remove the few protesters who were there. They didn't say, hey guys, you got a couple hours here, fair enough, make your point, and then you got to go home. There was none of that. So the protest was almost, the occupation was almost immediately, implicitly sanctioned by the police.
And whose decision was that to do it that way?
Well, we never know, really. I was not able to ascertain for sure. My belief is that it was a combination of the Liberal government, well-intentioned, obviously, not wanting a repeat of Iberwash, which was another Native occupation in 1995, where an Aboriginal man named Dudley George had been killed. They didn't want a repeat of that. Nobody wanted a repeat of that, so I think the government was acting with good intention, probably. The upper levels of the OPP had already committed to a different course of policing at the Iberwash inquiry, which this different form of policing suggested that, when an Aboriginal occupation or a blockade takes place, one must approach it differently. It's not an ordinary situation. It's the expression of land claim. The land claim is the superior right, and therefore all other rights are subject. They're subjugated to it. So we will police it purely as a peacemaker kind of thing. We'll keep the peace, we won't make arrests. And they were committed to that out of the Upper Wash Inquiry. So
how long was it before it got violent?
Well, it didn't get violent until the in the courts. In the meantime, the developer, who was not a big rich Toronto developer, but a small local guy with a long history, long family connections in the building industry, he and his brother, who are the principals in their company, the Henning brothers, they found a lawyer and went to court and said, "Hey, we got to do something here. All these guys are out of work. You know, about 100 people who had been working every day on the site, we're no longer able to work, the developer is losing money, and you know, his whole future is going up in smoke around him. What's he to do?" So he gets a lawyer, and the lawyer goes to court, and they get an injunction to have the protesters removed. But the OPP, for reasons known only to it, resist actually executing the search warrant, or the injunction, and when they finally do on April 20th, they do it as a early pre-dawn raid. It's not very well sussed out. They seem to have forgotten that Six Nations itself, the reserve, is just across the road, and the enforcement can be brought in, and that's exactly what happened. The OPP was driven off the land by natives brandishing all sorts of makeshift weapons and yelling, and the OPP, with their tail between their legs, withdrew. And from that moment on, the violence began. The natives threw up barricades around the site, blocked railway lines, blocked the main road in Caledonia, main bridges, their bypass, issued so-called passports with the consent of the state, apparently, because nobody ever tried to stop them. If you lived anywhere near that occupied site and you were trying to go to your house, you had to show a native-issued passport. You were subjected to illegal search and seizure at the whim of the natives. Sometimes they had curfews. Occasionally, apparently, they demanded, body searches. And at the same time, there were egregious acts of violence, other sort of swarming of a couple. Police vehicle was hijacked. Really, the list goes on. A builder was beaten into a permanent state of brain damage. All of this happened usually with the OPP standing by, and sometimes the people doing the attacking were actually running through police lines, and the police were letting them go.
Now, we've heard a lot of about in this part of the country recently about Julian Fantino because he's running for the Harper Conservatives in Vaughan. He was the OPP commissioner at the time, was he?
He was the second. He took the job over from Glenn Boniface, who was the OPP boss when Caledonia started, and who I believe was, certainly a leader in setting the tone and the voice and the way that they would approach it. Mr. Fantino had a very tough law and order reputation as former chief of York Region and Toronto and a bunch of other big jobs. And when he took it over in late 2006, the expectation, certainly among the, people of Caledonia, I think among the police themselves, was that finally, at last, they had a tough police commissioner who would, restore some common sense to this issue, and instead, he kept the OPP on the same path to which his predecessor had committed them.
Now, you didn't talk to him for this book?
Oh, I tried. I tried very hard. And bear in mind, I've been a reporter writing about cops and crime for a long time, and I had a very good relationship with Julian Fantino in his many incarnations before. I thought perhaps I was, imagining how kindly I'd written about him before, so I had a researcher at the Globe and Mail check it and evaluate all stories. I think I'd done more than three dozen stories or about three dozen columns over the years at various newspapers about him. Every time, without exception, I had been supportive of him. So I certainly had no axe to grind. I had this very good reputation or relationship with him. And yet when I asked for a formal interview with him for the purposes of the book, his spokesman declined. I offered then to say, come and do the interview. Mr. Fantino could have a lawyer present if he was worried. And I promised not to ask him about certain subjects that were then still making their way through the courts. And they still said no. So I don't know what his explanation would be. That will be for him to make, I guess, in another format.
Yeah, and then the reaction from say, frontline OPP officers is very much different than the actual OPP itself, right? You talked to a
Absolutely.
Lot of...
Absolutely. The front ranks of the OPP, I think, felt shattered and betrayed by their orders. Sometimes these orders were explicit. Sometimes they were implicit. But the message was very clearly sent that this is an Aboriginal occupation. You are not going to act the way you normally act as police officers. You are going to act as peacemakers. And they were, I think, embarrassed, sometimes mortified at their own conduct. I mean, there was one instance where when a police vehicle was hijacked and an OPP officer who'd been stuck inside and hadn't got out in time finally kicked open a door and jumped from a moving vehicle, knocked himself unconscious as he hit the ground, and the native guy who was driving the vehicle put it in reverse and tried to run him over. This happened in front of two OPP officers who were regularly posted at that location, who did not lift a finger to help one of their own. And when you have cops not responding to a situation like that where one of their own is in danger, then you know that the rule of law is lost, for the citizen certainly.
Is this something that you wrote about a great deal in your column?
I didn't write at all about it. I was in Afghanistan for most of the spring and summer of 2006 working on my other book about Canadian soldiers, and I think I went to Caledonia once when I was briefly back in Canada. But last fall, when this lawsuit, the Dave Brown civil lawsuit, began to be heard in court in Hamilton, Ontario, I knew a little bit about it. I thought I knew a lot, but it turned out it was a little. And I covered that trial, every day of that trial. And I can tell you unreservedly that the Ontario government, lawyers for the Ontario government and the Ontario Provincial Police, did not contest the truth of the allegations that Dave Brown made against them in the lawsuit or that I make in the book. I mean, they agree. They didn't act the normal way. And they say, the lawyers say, that the reason they didn't act the normal way and the reason they threw the people of Caledonia under the bus, basically, is because it was a native land claim issue. Well, that's a very dubious thing to say, because the land claim is not recognized by the only body in the country which is able to negotiate land claims. And secondarily, the worst of the violence happened well away from the occupation site and far beyond any potential legitimacy that a land claim could have offered.
When was it that you wanted to write this book?
I guess the first day of the Dave Brown civil lawsuit, so that would be last November.
Yeah. Now, one of the critics of the book says that you should talk about land claims, and failing to do so, you don't give a full picture of what happened here.
I don't pretend it's a full picture. What I pretend it is, or what I say it is a full picture of the rule of law aspect of it. I'm not native. I'm not a land claim expert. I don't pretend to be, and I'm so old now that I couldn't become one even if I had, you know, another 30 years of productive life left. I mean, I leave that to other people. But what this is about, natives are parties to the rule of law agreement too. Native Canadians are. We all agree that we're going to be bound by the same set of laws, and we're going to be subject to the same set of laws and considered equal under those laws. And that means that, for instance, when I burn down your house, you don't come back to my house and burn my house down. What you do is call the police, and the police investigate, and somebody prosecutes, and ultimately a judge or a judge and jury decides the matter. If you don't subscribe to the rule of law, what you end up with is the very kind of situation that I was covering in Kandahar that summer. You know, lawlessness, anarchy, long blood feuds where people settle things on their own, and there's no rule of law.
Do you think something that comes out of this book and learning about this, people like myself who probably didn't pay attention to this when this all happened, is that we can learn to talk to each other, perhaps, or get along better, maybe?
Well, I don't know. I think the people of Caledonia and the people of Six Nations have proven that you can, you know, move on, that they have, I think, you know, there's a lot of, it's kind of like the family that has a big fat ghost in the closet or a skeleton in the closet, and everybody can manage to ignore it for a fair long piece of time, and then periodically it'll pop out and it gets ugly, and then you pop it back into the closet. So I think that's the stage they're in that town right now. But I think the lesson is not that we can, you know, shouldn't we all talk to each other more? I mean, natives and non-natives have lived together for several hundred years in peace and as good neighbors in Haldimand County. It's not about them learning to talk to each other. It's about government having the backbone to govern, the police having the balls to police, and everybody to expect the same treatment under the law. That's it. You don't get to claim special status. You don't get to commit crimes that would get any other citizen arrested because of your skin color, your ancestry, or your race. It's antithetical to everything we stand for in this country.
Have things changed? I mean, what's going on there now?
It's very quiet there now because, effectively, the government bought the land from the developer for $15 million of Ontario taxpayers' money. That was a de facto way of handing it to the natives, to Six Nations, without the government having the courage to formally do it and say, in other words, okay, we're making a gift of this land to the Six Nations people. They didn't do that. They bought it. The government of Ontario owns it, which means the people of Ontario own it. Yet the people of Ontario are not welcome to go on it. It is a no-go zone for the citizens, the non-native citizens of Caledonia. And more importantly, it's a non-go zone, a no-go zone for the police. And that much, the current commissioner of the OPP told a meeting of the rank and file when they get periodically to meet with the brass. He was the deputy commissioner then, and one of the OPP members asked, are we allowed, and this was 2 years after it started, he said, are we allowed to go on DCE? And the answer from Chris Lewis, Commissioner Chris Lewis, came back and said, no, only in exceptional circumstances such as a fresh child abduction. So, you know, you want to break the law in Haldimand County, you sure know where to go.
Yeah. What do you think people in BC say should learn from all of this?
Well, this kind of blockades happen in British Columbia, and they happen all over the country. So we all know this is not a unique to Ontario issue. We all live cheek by jowl, native and non-native in this country. So I think what we have to do is, first of all, have higher expectations of our government that they will enforce, will enforce the rule of law to which we are all bound and to which we all agreed many years ago, that no group of citizens shall expect special treatment over another, and that, you know, government has to be brave when it is painful to be brave, because everyone knows that in Canada, Aboriginal Canadians have got the short end of the stick many times. It is tempting to see them purely as victims. But they aren't always victims. They can be villains, just as any of us can be villains. You know, we're fully human. We are fully capable of the range of human behavior. And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. And when it's bad, we ought not to be afraid to say it's bad just because the people who are being the villains at the moment are native.
What's next for you, Christy?
You mean when my little book tour is over?
Yeah.
I'm going to go to sleep for a while. I don't know what's next. As soon as this is done, I'm going back to covering, the criminal courts for the Globe and Mail, and maybe write my next book, which is supposed to be my current book, on the justice system. So we'll see.
You know, I was in preparing for this. I keep a file for guests and prospective guests on the sort, and there's a file for you that I've been keeping since your National Post days, and the clippings and things that I've pulled of yours and just kept in there. I mean, there's some great stuff there. I mean, there's like a book there, you know, the stuff about your mom. There's a piece last night I read about AA. Have you ever thought about writing a book, say, of like old pieces of yours?
Years ago when I was writing a humor column, believe it or not, for the Toronto Sun, I did have sort of two collections of columns published, but even at the time, I didn't consider them real books. I sort of felt they were lazy writer books. At least they were for me. And I don't think I could look at myself in the mirror if I did another one of those again. I have a pretty good work ethic, and if I'm going to write another book, I'm going to do some original research and give it my all, whatever that's worth.
What about a memoir?
No memoirs. No, I'm out on that.
Yeah.
I've already told it all. Rosie DiMano, my great friend from the Toronto Star, columnist at the Toronto Star, we often joke, we're sometimes called the Twisted Sisters, and we joke that we would write a memoir, and it would be called jointly, it would be called Twisted Sister, a tell-all, know-nothing book, and that kind of says it all about my view of my memoirs.
Yeah. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you today. Good luck with this book, Christy.
Thank you very much, Joseph. Thanks for having me on.
The book is called Helpless, Caledonia's Nightmare of Fear and Anarchy and How the Law Failed All of Us. It's published by Doubleday. It's author Christy Blatchford on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.